What evidence do you have? I'm not talking about theory, supposition, hypothesis, reconstruction, Formgeschichte, or anything else. I just want to know, who has ever seen a testimony document? Who ever read the testimony document? Who ever translated the testimony document? Who can prove there is a testimony document? And is it not, in fact, the argument of Eusebius that because there were testimony documents which were used to build up certain cases for certain portions of the Old Testament, that this theory was adopted and read back into the New Testament times, and in fact, Rendell Harris is responsible for this, and there is no testimony document, and you simply adopted his hypothesis with no proof, evidence, or anything whatever. Is that not true?
No, it isn't.
I'd like to hear an exposition.
But it is partly true, that you say that Dr. J. Rendell Harris, who was one of my helpers and teachers in my earlier years, and whose memory I greatly revere, was one of the people, one of the first in modern times, to present to us the evidence for the existence of such a document on the basis of Syriac finds, and he was one of the greatest Syriac scholars who ever lived, and on the basis of certain statements that we have of the way in which particular texts are strung together, which we find strung together in this particular kind of way. And he found evidence not only in the New Testament itself for the existence of this testimony document, but he found it also in the, and ultimately in the collections which were used as proof texts against the Jews, as you know, St. Cyprian's collection, and so on. And in this fivefold book, which is always referred to, and of which we have an example in the five books of lost books now, of Papias, in which he claimed to be interpreting the oracles relating to Jesus from the Bible. We have in Justin Martyr similar statements, and the same kind of conjunctions made between certain prophet's statements and other prophetic statements joined together in a manner which any person treating all that evidence with the care that it should be treated must come to the conclusion that the people were employing all these people throughout a considerable period because they all make exactly the same mistakes as each other, even though they weren't connected with one another, that they were in fact using a form of testimony book in which the statements, predictions relating to the Messiah in the Old Testament were set out in this kind of form. I believe that evidence, piecing together all that we know from these patristic sources and from the others which Rendell Harris presented, are a very strong case indeed for the existence of such a work.
But still no work has ever been found.
That doesn't mean it won't be found.
Now, wait a moment. That's an argument from silence, a full
way. We haven't got Papias's five books.
But the point that I'm making, Doctor, is a very important point. Here you're making the testimony document one of the foundation things of the New Testament, and you haven't got any testimony document. You've got a hypothesis. That's an important point.
Hypothesis, because you can determine a document having once existed on a great deal of evidence that without having the actual document there available. Very often detection has been made, for instance, even in astronomy, it has been worked out that at a particular place there ought to be a particular planet, but nobody had ever seen it. And then scientific effort has discovered that there the planet was in the very place in which it had been anticipated it ought to be.
But this methodology is not textual criticism of the New Testament. It's pure hypothesis.
Not talking about textual criticism of the New Testament.
Dr. Schonfield, Hugh J. Schonfield, who is the author of the very controversial book titled The Passover Plot. And we've invited Will Owsler to be with us and the Reverend Walter R. Martin. He wanted to make one more statement because I want to give it back to Will.
As I said, I've cataloged all these different things where there is usage of various portions of the New Testament. And Dr. Schonfield makes statements about the New Testament. He quotes a section of the New Testament. And then he'll go along, starting to give an illustration of what I'm talking about in his introduction. as I quoted in the beginning, he said, "Where I have offered a theory which in the nature of things cannot be established, I have plainly stated this." Yet, as Will has pointed out before, he theorized on the drugging of Jesus and the part that Joseph of Arimathea played in it with no thought of a theory at all. It was a stated fact. In addition to that, on at least 12 to 14 different references here that I have marked in the book, he has quoted from the New Testament specifically and then gone on to invalidate other portions of the New Testament. One of the things, for instance, that is very interesting that he does is to say that John, the writer of the fourth gospel, makes Jesus say certain things, puts words in Jesus' mouth, which is an assumption, the assumption being that Jesus never said it. Then he will quote another portion of the Gospel of John, for instance, John chapter 5, as if it was perfectly valid. Now, by what authority do you say, in John chapter 20, John put these words in Jesus' mouth, but in John chapter 5, Jesus really said this? He also says that his criterion for the genuineness of the documents is quite interesting. I'm quoting now all from the Passover plot. I don't want it to be thought that this is my interpretation of what he is saying. I just want to quote what he has to say himself. For instance, statements like this. The community for which he wrote was still partly Jewish, but he himself was not a Jew. We're talking about Matthew now. And his written sources were Greek. Page 251. No Jew would have understood the Hebrew parallelism in Zechariah 9:9, etc. The Gospel of Matthew is most important to us for bringing us nearest to the testimony book. That's that elusive book that nobody's ever found. And for preserving sayings of Jesus which ring true. Now, who determines whether they ring true? Apparently, Dr. Schoenfield determines if they ring true. If they fit the Passover plot theory, they ring true. If they don't fit the Passover plot theory, they're not true. And then there's another quotation, page 251. It is unlikely, however, that Luke was the author, speaking of the Acts of the Apostles, since the Gospel must be dated around A.D. 105 and the Acts at least a year or two later. Well, I don't know how anybody knows when the Gospel of Luke was written in the second century, particularly when the consensus of scholastic opinion today is that the New Testament record is all completed within the first century and not the second century. In addition to this, one other thing, and then Will can take over from here. There's so much material here. It all comes out of Dr. Schoenfield's book. But he says some truly paralyzing things, and I can't understand how he can come up with these things. Page 200, concerning the Apostle Paul. Now, I know he's written a book on Paul, but I'm sure...
You mean Paul, Dr. Schoenfield's written
yes,
a book on Paul?
Yes, but I'm sure Paul will be most unappreciative of this statement. Such Jewish thinking, however, obviously did not imply the deity of the Messiah. Even the Hellenized Paul, in his mystical philosophy, never went as far as speaking of Christ as God. Though his doctrine of the Messiah as the preeminent expression of God is so delicately poised in its terminology that it could be misunderstood by those unacquainted with its peculiar esoteric Jewish background of thought connected with the archetypal man. Now, this is tremendously important, primarily because, according to the Apostle Paul, that's exactly who Christ was, literally deity. I have here a Greek New Testament. In fact, I have Dr. Schoenfield's own translation of the New Testament. In both the Greek New Testament and here, there are some interesting statements from the Apostle Paul. For instance, one of these statements in Colossians chapter 2, verse 9, which is a Pauline epistle. The Apostle says, "For in him," this is Jesus of Nazareth, "there dwells," the Greek is quite explicit, "pleroma tes theotetos somaticos," the fullness of the deity, Jehovah, in flesh. Not content to go on, that's incarnation. Not only that, but he goes on in Philippians chapter 2 to take the name of God out of Isaiah and apply it to Jesus of Nazareth, right out of the Isaiah passage. At the name of Jesus, substituting it for Isaiah's word, at my name, at the name of Yahweh or Jehovah, every knee shall bend and every tongue shall confess. And Paul takes it and applies it without a thought to the person of Jesus Christ. Pauline theology in Colossians 1 says it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell. The whole wharf and woof of Pauline theology in the New Testament, according to historic Christianity, is always the deity of Jesus Christ. Now, Dr. Schoenfield says, without a blush, that when Paul writes, it doesn't say anything about Christ as God. It's all in a mystical type of Hellenistic philosophy, which anybody who knows the New Testament theology and Pauline theology knows that Paul wasn't writing in Greek philosophy. He despised philosophy. In fact, he specifically says in Colossians, beware lest anyone despoil you de philosophia, through philosophy, after the rudiments of this world and not after Christ. So he's not Hellenized in philosophy. He's the man that stood on Mars Hill and reversed philosophy by proving that Athens and Jerusalem had nothing in common, as Tertullian pointed out. I would like to know, Dr. Schoenfield, by what authority you say Paul did not teach the deity and the incarnation of Jesus Christ, especially since your New Testament and the Greek New Testament specifically affirms it.
Well, no,
he's asking a question to Dr. Schoenfield. You are not Dr. Schoenfield.
No, not
fine.
Yet.
Thank you.
I think it's
much.
A fair question.
Certainly, you may ask the question. But you've raised a great point about philosophy, Greek philosophy, when you have actually quoted me as saying that Paul obtained this from esoteric Judaism. This is the whole point that you've missed.
You said Hellenized Paul. I
said Paul was Hellenized, but I said
that
he obtained... No, you quoted me. And please don't go back on your own words. My words which you read.
Even the Hellenized Paul.
Yes, and go on.
In his mystical philosophy.
Go on.
Never went as far as speaking of Christ as God.
Yes, quite. But you went too
far
than that.
His doctrine of the Messiah, as the preeminent expression of God, is so delicately poised in its terminology that it could be misunderstood by those unacquainted with its peculiar esoteric Jewish background.
Precisely.
Connected with the archetypal man.
Precisely. Now, that's just the point. This is the point that you've chosen to ignore. The point that Paul's expression of the Messiah, the Christ, in his Christological conception, was, in fact, based on the mystical teaching of the Pharisees in connection with the archetypal man, of which we have a great deal of evidence, and as you seem to know my works fairly well, if you've read the Jew of Tarsus, you will know that I have given a full explanation of that with chapter and verse for everything, and quoted the actual references. And you haven't read my book.
I haven't read your book on Paul.
Ah, well, there you are. Then, in fact, in that book, I have given a complete detailed explanation of all that Paul said. And if you read Paul's writings, you'll find that in no place does he say anywhere use the word God in connection with Jesus. He always distinguishes Jesus from God. He talks about God and the Lord Jesus Christ.
No, that's not true, sir.
It is true, sir.
No, sir. Here's a Greek New Testament. Would you translate Colossians 2:9 for me?
This is not
that's Greek.
Relevant.
It's very relevant.
2:9.
Yes, sir. As it reads in the Greek. And
I'm glad you didn't ask me to do it. Because
wait a minute, you're in the Acts of the Apostles here.
No, I just hand it to you. I know where I am.
I thought you were handing me the page.
No, I just handed you the Testament. This is a lexicon by one of the world's foremost Greek scholars, who is a Unitarian, who would be in agreement with you normally. So I'll be interested in your comments and his.
Dr. Schoenfield has the book that was given to him by Reverend Walter Martin. And now Dr. Schoenfield is looking for the particular... You got to read that, sir?
Yes. This is that in him you are united and dwelling that... all the fullness or completeness of the Godhead bodily was in him. This is quite
what is the word translated Godhead?
Theotetos, divinity.
Oh, no. That's no, sir.
Yes.
No, sir. That's the point
absolutely.
Where your Greek goes off.
Now, if you will...
Stay with that passage. You have to stay with
this passage because I'm saying something which you have refused to take any account of, that wherever Paul refers to God and Christ, he always distinguishes them. He always speaks about God or God the Father and then proceeds to our Lord Jesus Christ. He never says the God Jesus Christ or anything of that sort.
You're quite confident of this?
Absolutely positive.
Romans 9:5, he who is God, over all, blessed forever.
That is a famous mistranslation which is has been corrected in the New English Bible.
Well, that's been corrected in the New English Bible.
Yes, because this is a deliberate and willful mistranslation of the Greek.
And what you just said isn't a deliberate
and
mistranslation.
And the correct translation is
just a moment. You mistranslated the key word of Colossians 2:9.
No, I haven't.
You translated theotetos, divinity.
Yes, it is.
It is not. According to Thayer's Greek-English lexicon, theotetos differentiates from theotes, which is divinity, as essence differs from quality. So the text should read, not the divine nature, but deity in essence is in him. He is God.
This is some Christian interpretation.
He's a Unitarian. He believes as the Jews do.
But it's nothing. There's no connection with the origins of the Greek word in what you're saying.
Dr. Stormfield, can I ask you a question about this knowledge of Greek that you have?
Could you use the microphone?
A very important question.
Thank you.
Your flyleaf here lists that you received your education at the University of Glasgow. Is that right?
Yes.
According to a cable which I sent to Great Britain, they tell me that you also went to St. Paul's School, the University of Glasgow, King's College, and the University of London. Did you take any degrees in Greek?
No, I didn't. I was a classic scholar.
Did you take any? You took degrees in any of this?
No, I certainly didn't take degrees, but I was a classic scholar. I was trained in Greek and Latin from the age of 11 and 12.
But you have no degrees in the field of biblical knowledge.
I haven't. It's biblical knowledge. And yes, I hold a doctorate of sacred literature.
By conferral.
By conferral.
But you didn't earn this.
No, because I never particularly set myself to graduate in these in particular languages or anything of that sort.
But, sir, how can you translate the New Testament?
Because I have,
Let me ask you a question.
The study of this language.
Well, all right, if you maintain the study of the language, how is it you don't know the difference between divinity and deity in the Greek?
I would say you don't know the difference.
Well, I'm not saying it. One of the world's greatest authorities on Greek grammar is saying it, and I brought him in here for your benefit, not mine. I've got 30 volumes over there by the same people. They're not all wrong, and you're right.
The Greek word for God, as we know, is theos.
Right.
You see. Theotetes is a quality of deity.
Not theotetos.
Yes.
No, sir. This is the very point I'm trying to make. This is what you do in your translation. This is what you do in your book. You make statements. And when somebody comes along who really knows what they're talking about and knows the references...
I'd like to submit this.
Now, just
to
I'll let you, John, can I finish
scholars.
The statement? Can
just
I submit a statement?
Just for a moment. I think that we're going to get involved in something
very
here that
something
no one...
Academic.
That actually will be of no value to our listeners, really.
Well, this is of real value because here's a man who,
well, now,
who is called on the flyleaf of this book one of the world's leading biblical scholars who has no degrees in biblical theology.
That's accepted, sir, by...
By whom?
By scholars. Well, by people that have been on
by
this
liberal
program.
Liberal scholars
no,
who
no,
agree with him.
No, 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 I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Are you considered to be an expert?
In one field.
What?
Comparative religions.
Uh-huh. I have some telegrams here. Please give Mr. Sconfield credit for trying. As time goes on, he can improve. He is talking about Jesus Christ, remember. Here's one more. If Christ was God, how could he die? If he was resurrected, then he didn't die. Enjoying your program, Mrs. Serlin. Here's one from Providence, Rhode Island. Two guests might well learn Dr. Sconfield's apparent theory. Words, and then this is in quotes, should, ought, must, right, wrong, end of quote. Apparently lacking in his vocabulary, rightfully so. Congratulations, Mr. Nabel, for choice of author of Passover Plot. This is from S. Herman of Providence, Rhode Island. Here's another one from Wayne, New Jersey. This is your hometown, I think. Thank you, Dr. Sconfield, for affirming my Christian faith by your Passover Plot, but thank God for Walter Martin, the true disciple of our day. Dorothy Carazzolo, a born-again Christian. And then we have one more, Dr. A. Sava. I think he is a medical doctor. Please remind the author on your panel the fact that blood and water came from the side of chest of Christ when the lance pierced. It does not at all prove that Jesus was still alive. A large volume of bloody fluid does, in fact, accumulate inside the chest as a result of repeated blows on the chest, and this does not clot, but its nature settles, by its nature settles into two layers, and its accumulation gradually diminishes the lung capacity, which reduction will kill.
Is this a medical man?
He says doctor, so I'm assuming momentarily. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said doctor, most likely because he is bringing up some
she's talking about a lot of blows on the chest, which we haven't any evidence of.
I would like to make one statement here, which I would like to make personally, as well as to raise this point to our author tonight, and that is that there are many interpretations of the life of Jesus and whether he was God or not. I happen to agree very closely with the opinion of Bishop Pike in this regard, who feels that Jesus was the most divine of men, but that he was a man. And I accept that. This is why your theory becomes so distasteful to me. Because if we were arguing on the issue of whether Jesus was God or the Son of God or the Son of Man or any of these ancient terminologies, that's one argument. But when we come down to talking about the man Jesus, which you say you were talking about, and which I am talking about too, and which many modern thinkers do think of Jesus as, we think of him as being the most divine of men, a very good thing. We think of his healings as being real. From your book, I gather you don't believe in any of them, or at least not as anything of a miraculous nature, of a supernatural nature. This is another example of your picking and choosing, which I think should be pointed out. But the thing that is important is that your theory, dealing with him as a human being, makes him truly a criminal because he conspired to commit a complete deception on the world. And this is what I think is the point that Christians should consider. Not whether we think of Jesus as being Jesus the Christ, God in person, or Jesus the Christ, the Son of God, or Jesus Christ, the closest divinity that we have. To me, that's the most happy thing to believe, because he said, all men are my brothers, and I like to feel that he meant that. But I wouldn't want to be the brother to a man who would commit a fake crucifixion on a cross, and I don't think Jesus would either. And that is why I am against this book.
May I say this, that you wanted to quote Bishop Pike. Bishop Pike tells us that God didn't choose Christ, but Christ chose God. And he goes on to speak of the resurrection. I'm talking, quoting Bishop Pike. Of the resurrection, Bishop Pike says, the real Christ is not a revived corpse. And also, there is another thing that's interesting. He tells us that the Muslims offer one God and three wives, and that we offer three gods and one wife, and no wonder Christianity is losing in Africa. Now, these are not my opinions, my quotes, rather.
Well, I don't always agree with the...
Oh, I see. When you don't like it, then you disagree.
I must say, I think that...
rather fortunate I had a lot of...
I have some... I've got it right here. I can read it out of time, too.
I see.
But the truth... John, I tell you, I like Bishop Pike for one reason. I disagree with him about a lot of...
Yes, may I say this also? As Dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, Bishop Pike celebrated a memorial service for Sigmund Freud on the atheist's 100th birthday.
Why not? God would have too.
Mm-hmm.
God doesn't dislike atheists, and many people believe that God loves atheists just as much as...
You said that God doesn't dislike or doesn't like?
No, I said God does not dislike atheists.
How do you know that?
Because...
I'm not debating because I don't know. How do you know he does or does not dislike?
I'm sure that Bishop Pike would agree with me in the fact that, and many religionists now agree with the concept, that God loves all of his creation, that we are a part of that creation, and that our love for each other, which Christ tells us as a new commandment, behold, I give you a new commandment, that ye love one another, which is not in the Ten Commandments, you see. So this was a new commandment which Christ gave to the world. This is a part of the concept of love, which makes Christ the central focal point of love in the universe, and should. And this is what many metaphysicians are talking about today. And this is why the theory that the person who symbolizes love, decency in the terms of caring for your fellow man, whether he's a drunkard or an atheist or a bum, he says that. He says, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. This is another one of the great statements. which cannot be ascribed to a man who would have been involved with what I call a cheap, shabby plot, such as this plot is. This is a charlatan that this man is writing about. It is not a man of love. It's a charlatan.
May I ask you this? Do you also believe in the Trinity and the virgin birth?
No.
Oh, you don't? Okay, fine. So then you agree with Pike on that?
I certainly do.
Okay. Right now...
I told you that I agree with him on many things that Walter and I would disagree on.
Fine. Professor Walter R. Martin, director of the Christian Research Institute in Wayne, New Jersey. It certainly is unfortunate that at this late date that they have to do research. One would figure that they would know by now. Also, Reverend Martin, associate minister of the Van Riper Ellis Memorial Church in Fairlawn, New Jersey. We have Will Ousler with us. Mr. Ousler is a well-known writer and a delightful gentleman in most all areas, possibly except religion. I have great respect for him because he is a bright, bright man, Will is. And this, I think he becomes emotional rather than intellectual.
I beg your pardon, John.
Yes, we have the author of The Passover Plot with us, and I would like to take a moment to remind our listeners that as of November 13th, which is just about 2 months ago, 140,000 copies were in print. Now, The Passover Plot asserts and presents detailed documentation as proof that Jesus planned his own arrest, crucifixion, and resurrection, and that he arranged to be drugged on the cross, simulating death, so that he could later be removed and revived. Now, this is a very, very controversial book. However, many members of the clergy have recommended it and have been extremely complimentary to Dr. Sconfield. In fact, Dr. Miller Burroughs of Yale University has this to say about the book. I am really grateful for this book, along with much that to me is quite incredible, if not fantastic. I find also a great deal that is suggestive, stimulating, even moving. And the Washington Daily News suggests, read The Passover Plot first, then argue. It may well become the book of the year. And America gives this recommendation an excellent challenge. And, of course, a gentleman that our friend Will Ousler has great respect for, in fact, Will writes for the Christian Herald, Dr. Daniel A. Poling, has said about The Passover Plot, a startling book. The author reveals himself as a more careful student of the New Testament than many Christians who read it devotionally. I think that maybe Dr. Poling is thinking of you.
Did he go on from there?
No, but I'm going to go on. I got this cream cheese and the olive. Say a word? You're through talking?
No.
Okay. Do you have a question for Dr. Sconfield?
Yes. I would like to ask Dr. Sconfield.
You did 23 minutes before. Please, let Will.
Have a little bit. Let me have a little bit, Walter. And then
you
I'll,
had your turn. Be my guest.
I'd like to go back. You see, I still regard this as a crime story and an interesting one in which you set up
this a... This sounds like a repeat of our show. Are you playing back a tape or is this new material that Will
is using? This is new material.
Okay.
You go on to say here one thing that that I wonder about. You question as completely unacceptable the story of Lazarus. Is that correct?
No. This is not so.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that, because then we can talk about
it. I didn't say it was completely unacceptable. What I've said was that we do not know what is behind this story. We have two accounts which are suggestive. One, in one gospel, we have a reference to this man having been raised by Christ from the dead, a miracle of very great consequence, which none of the other Gospels mention, but that another Gospel has a reference to a Lazarus in concerning with a parable which also deals with a question of resurrection. Consequently, here we have elements of something. We cannot say what really happened, but we have elements of something which somehow has got into the tradition, and we don't know what was quite responsible for it.
I would put this in exactly in your, just as a normal reasoning human being, I'd put this exactly in the same category as your acceptance of Joseph of Arimathea. But now I'd like to raise this question. Suppose, sir, that for the sake of argument, we don't discount this section of the Bible that doesn't fit into your thesis, but nevertheless we'll accept it anyway, for the moment, theoretically, hypothetically. Suppose we accept the fact that the story, as related, of Martha and Mary coming to Jesus and telling him that Lazarus is dead, and Jesus going there, and that famous line of the Bible, Jesus wept, and then raising Lazarus. Suppose that story has to be accepted for the moment. If you did not reject it because it doesn't fit in with your thesis, sir, wouldn't you then have to conclude that it was also a part of the plot that his friend Lazarus was putting on an act too? Another extenuation of the same kind of deception that you allege Jesus attempted on the cross. In other words, if you do not have to reject the Lazarus story because it does not fit in with your thesis, and do have to accept it because of what you feel is certainly as sound as your acceptance of Joseph of Arimathea, well then, wouldn't you have to conclude that this was an additional part of the plot conducted by Jesus? In other words, wouldn't you have to tell us about this in order to, for us as Christians who foolishly accept all these things, wouldn't you have to tell us how we can explain these away?
I really don't feel able to carry on a kind of dialogue with anyone who insists and will not retract such a statement, that I select what suits me to carry on.
Now, this is what seems to me.
This is totally untrue, and I must repudiate it categorically. This is not the way a scholar works, and I have not worked in this way at all. And I must say quite very clearly and distinctly that what the conclusions which I have reached have been confirmed to me, not invented by me, on the basis of what came to me as a consequence of investigation of the different pieces of material that were there. I did not arrange a theory and then look around for what I could find to support it. This is a false and an untrue accusation.
Well, I want to say, sir, that
I'm not prepared to have any dialogue with anyone
make this,
on that basis.
I do not make this accusation. I am sure that you think that you developed it. However, I do say that on the basis of what I read in your book, and I am, sir, if I may speak a moment about myself, I am a fairly intelligent person. I've been a reporter and a student myself for some 35 years, so I am not completely an idiot when I pick up your book. And I am convinced, sir, that your statement in regard to this Joseph of Arimathea puts you in a position of having to say that the heart of your whole conclusion, your scholastic and scholarly achievement, is based upon a character whom you yourself admit you don't know where he came from. He's mentioned only once. And whereas when I mentioned Lazarus, you dismissed him because he was mentioned only once.
No, I didn't say he was mentioned. I said he was mentioned twice.
Well, in any case, the point
once
is that
another
here,
connection, and connection here with
you,
a parable.
Here you have gone on, and you say further along, such correspondences, that's referring to the correspondence of the two names, cannot be put down to coincidence. It has to be allowed that sources like Josephus have been employed to supplement the paucity of genuine recollections. And you go on to say the following. Generally, we must probe to extract elements in the traditions on which we can reasonably rely. Otherwise, we shall be building a house on sand and arguing about matters and sayings which have not been established as authentic. Continually, we must be aware of the circumstances which contributed to and helped to shape and develop the story of Jesus. All very well and good. But listen to what you say just before that.
it has to be allowed that sources like Josephus have been employed to supplement the paucity of genuine recollections which outlasted the overwhelming catastrophe of the Jewish war with Rome. We are consequently warned that we should not accept the testimonies of the gospel at face value and must employ every external agency available to check the information where we can. Generally, we must probe to extract elements in the tradition on which we can reasonably rely.
Now, what anybody does in carrying out any kind of historical investigation.
I would say if it were historical, it would be fine. Unfortunately, this isn't.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry, but at this point, we're going to have to make a slight change. Actually, in contacting Dr. Schoenfield when he was returning to New York and contacting the publisher, I had asked for Dr. Schoenfield to join again. Incidentally, this is my second show with him today. Not that he was on Versus, but I did a show for Monitor, and also he was at Judson Memorial Church tonight giving a lecture for 2.5 hours, and he has an early morning commitment at 9 o'clock. I had suggested to Dr. Schoenfield earlier that possibly we could work it out till about 2 or 2:15. I think he's been more than generous with his time because he does have this early morning commitment, and he did not know that he was going to be on the all-night show. Originally, he was under the impression he was going to be on the Versa show that he was on back some 3 or 4 months ago. So we thank you very much, Dr. Schoenfield, for joining us, and I hope when you're back in New York again that you will come back again. I'll try to bring 2 or 3 men on who possibly have greater knowledge of the subject.
Well, Long John, I think I ought to have to say just a word of thanks to you, because I have appreciated most deeply the way in which you have invited me so frequently, and the way that you have taken care of my reputation and helped me in every possible way you could. I think it's a very difficult matter when we allow ourselves to enter into an area of controversy which can have no constructive outcome, but one which can only help to exacerbate and make people express themselves perhaps in unwise and unkindly ways, when all the time we should be thinking, now, how is this going to make us better people out of this experience? Is this going to make us more humane, more kindly, more friendly to one another? And if it can achieve that, then I think it is serving a very valuable object. I do not think it is serving a valuable object if it is merely a question of saying, now, how many hounds can we set on to tear this Johnny to pieces? It may be perfectly valid, and I'm not contradicting this, perfectly valid that some things should be said in opposition to this. I would be a fool if I expected anything else. But let us above all try to see that there has been complete honesty of intention in all this work, and that the outcome of it has been, for the person who has been the author of this book at least, to feel that a greatness has attached to the person of Jesus which transcends this kind of controversy, and which makes him someone who today can be extremely relevant to our need and situation. This is my feeling, perhaps in the words of a certain playwright who portrayed the wandering Jew. I may be standing as a Jew here, nearer to the heart of Jesus than some who feel that they are championing his cause. Now, I don't put that forward with anything other than humility, but I do say that this man has made an enormous influence in my life. I think I've tried to make some contribution which can show that he still has an influence and a value and an importance for others. When it comes to theologizing, I'm not prepared to embark on arid disputation, which to me seems vain. But I can say that we can help one another to enlighten one another as much as we can, and I hope that this is the best way in which we can utilize the kind of book I've written. Thank you, John.
Long Thank time. You very much. Thank you for being with us.
We've been talking with the author of The Passover Plot, Dr. Hugh J. Schonfield.
And we have Will Owsley with us and the Reverend Walter Martin. And we continue right on because we have many things to discuss with the Reverend Walter Martin. I know that he had made some notes before, possibly wanting to enlighten the audience that he would like to concur with most of the things that I've said tonight. Am I in error?
No, I'm just surprised that Dr. Schonfield's analysis of our discussion, primarily in this area, because when one devotes 40 years of scholarship to the preparation of a manuscript, which is a primary assault upon the greatest figure on the horizon of history, and then does not expect a reaction to it, vigorous.
I think that if you were listening,
I mistake it.
You will realize that he just said that he never thought that he was writing a book that would not have people who would disagree on certain things. Yes, Mr. Aslan.
Well, I think it was nice of him to give himself such a fine send-off, and I want to concur with it. I enjoyed it very much. I don't think the evening was of no avail, because I do think the other side of the picture should be told. He's presented it from his side, and he doesn't quite like it when we presented it from ours. Now, Walter and I don't agree. Walter, I don't agree with you about 40% of the things that you say. But there's one thing we do agree with, and that is that we love the message that Jesus stands for. And I don't mean it in that metaphysical sense. I mean it when I saw a picture of an alcoholic lying in a gutter, and underneath it someone said, "This is Jesus." And in the terms that he meant when he said, "If you help this man, you have helped me," it is Jesus. And this is something so fine and so beautiful that it's relevant to all our times, Walter.
I would like to ask you a couple of questions, if I may, Mr. Owsley, because
yes,
of your...
Yes, sir. Oh, boy, I know when he calls me Mr. Owsley, I am in trouble.
No, because of your tremendous knowledge of so
nothing,
many subjects.
Nothing, yes.
And because we do have the Reverend Walter Martin here, we might be able to get into some areas other than the Passover plot. I think all of us have had a wonderful opportunity talking with Dr. Schonfield. You have all made your points and...
Well, we tried.
Well,
let's put it that way.
Okay. So,
they were all brushed off rather successfully as distortions.
Don't think so.
May I ask you this, Walter, if Jesus Christ were here tonight, do you think that he would handle himself in the manner which you are doing at this present
moment? I don't think our Lord would be here.
You don't think so? No. Why, he wouldn't like to be on this show?
Well, I wouldn't say that. He always liked to come where the sinners are, so he'd be here for you, John, right away, instantaneously, and for the rest of us.
Well, you're not a sinner, are you?
I said for the rest of us.
I don't want you on this show if you're a sinner, Walter.
For the rest of us.